everybody folding right now?
This is the one I'm taking home.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And this one, I guess, is for Heather.
This is the package?
Yes. Be brave. I'll let you open.
Discuss the recent influx of non-natives to New Orleans as it relates to housing crisis and community.
We already kind of started talking about that.
Right.
We did.
Make sure you say your name.
Start over.
Oh, yeah.
We might want to introduce ourselves. I think they're going to do voice recognition. Is that on?
Voice recognition?
Yes.
Yeah, it's on. You are being recorded.
Yes.
Did you all go around and introduce yourselves?
We did not.
Do we have to hold it when we speak?
So this is table 2/8.
Yes.
We were originally /8.
New Orleans. And everyone's going to go around and introduce themselves. And yeah, however you guys want to divvy up the cards, there's a lot of questions.
I'm David McClellan from Andover, New York.
My name is Deborah Anderson. I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan, and been in New Orleans since 2008.
Hi, I'm Brandon Washington. I was born and raised in New Orleans East and spent a good chunk of my life in Mississippi.
My name's Erica Christmas. I've been in the city for about a year now, but I'm from New York.
First question we have here is discuss the recent influx of non-natives to New Orleans as it relates to housing crisis and communities.
I may defer this question to you guys because I'm a non-native who doesn't live here and haven't seen very much of what's happening.
I was thinking about what you said earlier about people who move into the city because of the beauty and the visual and the culture. And I think a lot of the culture in New Orleans itself is the people. So if they get priced out, what does that do to the culture? Since most people who contribute to the culture tend to be lower income also in this city. When I say culture, I mean like just like brass bands and mostly musically.
And food?
Food, yes. But the food is more less socioeconomic than the music.
I think, I've asked this question of how does New Orleans progress as a city but also keep its culture at the same time? Like, it's like it seems impossible in what New Orleans culture is based around, because the remodeling of like where I used to work in the O'Keefe and Gravier area, where it looks totally different from when I worked there 2 years ago, and I'm like, who are they doing this for?
Right.
Because, okay, we have GE, but who else is buying these houses that are priced so high?
Right.
Like, what other companies are here that pay that amount of money where these people can take? Or is it the Airbnb people who buy and then, because that's a situation that I read recently in an article of how they're going to have a lawsuit with that, because you're coming into a residential neighborhood and then all these these visitors are coming into your neighborhood and messing up what your neighborhood should be and coming in drunk when there's like areas for that.
Right.
Even those areas, like in Frenchman, people are complaining, okay, I moved by Frenchman Street, but why are these people loud at night? And it's like, did you know where you were moving to?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of. I feel like a lot of the bars and like the residential areas aren't they're all very intermingled. So the loudness, I'm not sure how to describe that. Because I'm thinking of, let's say, the issue that came up with Mimi's and the Marini. All the houses in the area didn't have a problem with Mimi's. Or if they did, it didn't say anything. And then a new owner moved in right next door to Mimi's, and they felt like they weren't familiar with them. And then they started to complain, and like, then the whole culture of that area changed. Well, the culture didn't change significantly, but they stopped having music on. They stopped having music at all.
And I think it's a delicate balance, because the world is very much like the country itself is a melting pot. It's people from all over who want to come here and be here in the city, right? So it's trying to find that balance between what is native and what's considered native, and then what is considered acceptable to, I guess, like further whatever the identity of the city is. But everybody, because there are so many people here, and there are so many people who have interest in the city now, there are a whole lot of different opinions about what New Orleans is.
Yeah, and I feel like people move down here because they like the culture of New Orleans, and
right.
Then they move to a certain neighborhood, and I guess they didn't realize what they were getting into with 24-hour New Orleans, and now they want to change it, and it's like, but you came here because you liked it, and
right.
Now you're changing it.
This is 24-hour city.
Yeah.
I have a question. You guys are from others. You've been to other cities. I haven't been to many other cities. With entertainment and your residential, I guess what I'm asking is that very much separated from neighborhoods? Like your entertainment's here and your neighborhood's there. Whereas New Orleans, it's very much entertaining.
I've never been anywhere that has been like, or where things have been so integrated, where it's just like, this is what it is. Like, this is the part every day. Like, you can walk out at any time, anywhere, and there is some type of art, there's some type of light here in the city.
Yeah.
And I definitely have not found that's the people.
Then maybe that's what causes issues. People aren't used to like that happening.
I mean, I used to live in Boston for like 7 months, and they were having a very similar problem. Not in terms of like their actual overall culture, but just in terms of like the house show scene and the music scene, because there were like a lot of like underground venues that were in houses and DIY spots that were like getting shut down because of neighbors' complaints. And so it's really interesting to like be here for a year and see that that's happening. And I mean, I still don't feel like I'm adequate enough to like really speak on the issue, but it's just kind of strange to me. It's like, why would you come down to New Orleans of all places and expect it to be like quiet and suburban, you know?
Because I think they expected it to be over there.
Yeah, and
be very separate. Like, they figured it was all on Bourbon and on Frenchman, and not at the end of the block.
Yeah.
Well, also must be interesting for you, though, in East New Orleans, where you have a Vietnamese community that appears, you know, all of a sudden, literally, because it wasn't a long, gradual process. They were refugees, and boom, all of a sudden, they've established a spot. And now, you're getting a Hispanic community that's intermingling with that, and you have the group of Vietnamese who feel like, oh, but this was our neighborhood. And you're thinking, well, that's a fairly short memory, in a way.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the Vietnamese community. I guess I was too young to really think about it. All I knew was they had their little pocket in the East. And I feel like it wasn't an issue with the other community. They were just, yeah.
I know from my boyfriend living, I mean, he's from Battery, Canada, one of those. And from before Katrina, like the neighborhood by Lakeside Mall being all a certain color, and then seeing so many Hispanic people come in is just like new. And then when you go to different neighborhoods in New Orleans where it was all black, and you see like some white person jogging down the street exercising, and you're like, they never would have been there before Katrina.
Yeah.
And it's like, I guess it's like a culture shock for
it
people.
It is jarring.
Who live here. Because the dynamics of the neighborhoods are changing so much. But that's because people were pushed out, so people had to take their place.
And again, that's what I like when I talk about walking that fine line. It's between
change is fine. It's just, I guess it's the type of change that people feel like is happening.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Right.
Or perhaps the thought that goes behind that change.
The intent, yeah.
Yeah.
The intention, basically.
And, I mean, a big thing about New Orleans is its architecture. And when you're progressing, you're not going to build like a Victorian or like old school.
You're not going to replicate it. You're going to make it.
Yeah, you're
going to
take it. It's more expensive to do it that way. So you're going to build up these like skyscrapers that don't look like New Orleans, but that's how people build things these days.
I mean,
cheaper cost, and they don't really have to worry about the repercussions because they're not going to be living in these houses, you know.
But honestly, like when people come to New Orleans, like friends and family who've like never really been here, kind of want to explore the city, it's funny because I think the randomness of the architecture plays into the New Orleans as well, right? And so I always tell people it's like a child designed the city. I'm gonna throw this here.
Have you been on the intersection down St. Bernard?
Trying to make a left turn in the city. It's nuts. It's like, you know, like, I need to go right here, but I have to drive 2 miles before I can turn here. You know what I mean? Like, there are so many nuances to the city.
But that's also part of the charm.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yes, we all do kind of think, how am I going to do this? When five streets come together, there it is.
I'm Dwayne Slick.
Yep.
So the next card says there are 100,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans than there were 11 years, and it stops there. I assume that it means ago. Constitutes I understand like the need for structure and for discipline, you know, like, but again, it's about finding that balance. And I think charter schools are unbalanced. But I also believe that like the school system outside of the charter system is like, they gotta be able to find some type of like middle ground in order for people to progress and to be able to understand things while also still being able to be themselves. And I think that's like at the heart of people still want to be who they are without being like told.
There was just recently a 7-year-old somewhere, I don't know, where he got in trouble and they threatened to suspend him because he had like a long perm in his hair. And it's just like, like when I was in school, high school, like people came like spiked, even in middle school, people came with spiked hair. How does that distract? Like all you're doing is like, oh my gosh, they have spiked hair. And then you go to class.
The why is really important. The why is really important.
Exactly. Why are you distracted by this? Don't worry about what you're like.
It's the administrators and teachers that are distracted more than the students. But
it seems like this is a microcosm of the larger problem, which is controlling behavior. And who gets to define what behavior is really threatening?
Yeah.
I mean, is it really honestly going to disrupt school if it's on the left or the right, your part?
Yes, the right, because when with this zero tolerance policy, broken window policy that's in the charter school system, it's setting them up for failure. And like you were saying earlier, if you compare to wherever else in the world that they do this, it's in prison. Like, would you have to walk on a line, or you have to like raise your hand and you get in a 90 degree angle, or you're in trouble. And it's like ridiculous.
It's crazy. And like, they actually, in some charter schools, they actually give you little like stickers or cards for being good. And it's like they don't really allow
in high school.
Yeah, in high school, in middle school, and like elementary school. And it's just like, it's just a really warped way of thinking, because it's like, how do you know what's good for these kids? You don't know their trauma, you don't know where they come from, you're not trying to learn that.
I feel like that kind of system would cause trauma.
Yeah, it's a different culture, because it's like, whether it's Teach for America or Teach NOLA, people who are either white or of a different socioeconomic status, and like, how do you determine what is proper behavior for someone you don't know? So it's like, if you go to these schools that they came from, that's not how you discipline the children. So why is it how you discipline the black children? Like, where do you get this from? That is not from your history. And we're just like, I mean, I'm not personally a loud person, but that's, I mean, we're just flamboyant sometimes and expressive. And even when I become expressive about stuff, people are like intimidated. And it's just like, well, I feel strongly about this, so I'm gonna like raise my tone and get more expressive, but I'm not gonna hit you.
Right.
Yeah.
When I express myself, are the people enforcing, like imposing order on children?
Yeah.
Are they black?
They're mostly white.
Mostly white, yeah. And mostly through like Teach for America or like
most of the people who are not from here.
Yeah.
A lot of it's
yeah, because New Orleans is very different in that way. And when I first moved to New Orleans, I was working as an intern in one of the elementary schools on the West Bank in Algiers. And they had, during that school year, I only worked there for a year, during that school year they had 3 sixth grade teachers all Teach for America, and the first one was the one that lasted the longest, and she was pretty good, she just got tired, I guess. But the second one, it's like, where are you? It's a different culture. Where are you from if you come to a black school and just leave your purse and expect it not to be stolen out of? Like, that's stupid.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you're going to do the Teach for America thing, you need to teach culture, which apparently they supposedly do. But you don't leave your purse. Anyway.
Right.
That's another question. How do you teach a culture?
Without forming like a prejudice or something.
What's that?
Without forming a prejudice
exactly,
or something.
You know, like, because you understand your culture. I think until you are actually immersed in another culture and you've been there for a while, like, you can't come to New Orleans and
the previous question about how like people don't leave their communities. Like, it's very much, even within the city, every community is like, it's like going to a different, it's like different country, but like, it's, there's definitely a change in the culture from block to block. Not block to block, but from like community to community.
So, I feel like we addressed a lot of stuff, but we never discussed, all right, there are 100,000 fewer African Americans living in New Orleans than there were 11 years ago.
They're in Texas.
They are
in Florida.
But check it out. I think Katrina, I mean, I don't think there's anyone who can really argue, and people have tried to, that Katrina was not like a devastating experience for like the city. There are people, I remember I was at LSU at the time when the storm happened. I remember watching the news and seeing all the stuff happening back here. It was nuts. But we would have discussions in class, and I remember there were people who weren't from New Orleans who would say things like, well, it was probably for the best, you know what I mean? I would hear people say that. It was probably for the best that happened, you know, like, New Orleans needed to be, it's crazy to think, like,
there is this like a Christian community, maybe?
I know, I mean,
because New Orleans has a bad reputation. Summer of 2008. So coming back here in 2012 and seeing the city, the street for a while being put out.
Neighbors bought their house 8 months before we did for $10,000, and they had it on the market for $400,000 2 years ago. And as it turned out, they did not sell it because they wouldn't go below their price. But that speaks to this issue of the economics. They're African American, and they are benefiting from the gentrification in the neighborhood, because they wanted to move to another neighborhood. And the issue was schools. And this is so sort of universal. Everybody has these ideas. So it's like, yeah, I'd like a little yard, because we're a row house area where there's no greenery. We're right to the sidewalk. One yard for the kids, and I want good schools. And now that the neighborhood's gone up, I'd like to cash in on that rise. So it's an interesting point. They had the same issues we did about parking and about the construction of the new condos down the street. It's almost colorblind at that point.
It turns into socioeconomic.
It's economic issues. Yeah. And the issues revolve for everybody, and you can point at them. But where you expected the fault lines to run between the groups, they're running in other directions.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a fascinating thing.
See, it's very blurry. It's a blurry line. Because,
yeah.
You know, if you own your home for like 30 years, 20 years, and you see an opportunity to sell it for more than what you bought it for, and to help your family, and to like feed your grandchildren, and feed your kids, yeah, you're going to probably jump on it.
And not have to fix the roof and not worry about the foundation that's crumbling.
But it's also really, approaching you to sell your house. There's always like a big wig investor type who just wants to flip it and make it either to an Airbnb or like just rent it out for like $1,500 a month. So it's like, you know,
it's an interesting issue, because at the corner of our block is a Roman Catholic church, which was multi-ethnic, amazingly multi-ethnic. Native American, Irish, and African American, all three. A very interesting church. The Catholic diocese decided that the congregation was getting too small. They closed it, and they sold it to an African American Baptist congregation, who were then approached by those developers who said, hey, if you want to sell out and move your cramped no parking lot church and we can make 26 condos, you could walk out of here with $5 million. And they did. And you think, whoa, but like you say, those lines get so blurry.
I mean, from a church's perspective, that looks like a blessing, so.
Can go to another place where we can serve our congregation's needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not tied, we didn't build this church. It's not like it's rooted in our hearts. And the Catholic Church is like, you know, we do what we need to do. And then the developers, I see an opportunity.
Yeah, let's
then
jump on it.
Then the homeowners are all like, where in hell are we going to park now?
But what you said with schools, it reminded me of an article I read where it was saying how, I can't remember the city, but there was a school that was mostly African American that was doing very well and getting high test scores. And there was a friend, I think it was a white woman who wrote the article, how she was lived in this neighborhood and people were like, oh, you should take your child to this school and all this stuff. But they liked how the African American school did, and they liked that their child was in a diverse area. And then they had an idea, okay, these white people over here are going to create a diverse school, even though there's a diverse school right here that's mostly African American. But this diverse is according to what they think diverse is, like less black people than this school. So this is our diverse school, and we're going to do the same thing this school is doing, but our diversity is going to be on our terms.
See, and that's funny that you mentioned that, because I always say, define your term. what do you mean by that? You know, so let's dissect it, because maybe what I think the word means, you know, so you think about it, diversity. What is diversity? What constitutes diversity? And it's going to vary amongst everybody. And I think that's, it's interesting to kind of navigate that space and trying to define what is what according to your definition, and me comparing it to your definition and going, you know, because everybody has different concepts of everything. It's trying to like find, it's always difficult to find like a common ground amongst billions of people, you know what I mean? Like, we're never going to get there. But this is why this is cool. First off, this food was amazing. So this food was great. But this, like, I mean, I think just being willing to have a dialogue and be able to, like, talk about things like this, those things are, like, super, super important.
Because I think when you think about colleges and universities, they'll say they're diverse because, okay, we have this many international students, we have this many women students, we have this many out-of-towners, we have this many disabled people, but it's not necessarily people of color, like maybe some other people would think of diversity. It's like, okay, we have this many in this economic status. It's not necessarily centered around color like people usually think. It's more diversity in other areas of handicap or stuff like that.
I mean, I would say it's always about the intention at the end of it, you know? Because, like, you can say one thing. You can be like, oh, yeah, like, we want to be diverse. But, I mean, what I've noticed recently is that a lot of people are using diversity as a ploy. And that could mean anything, not just between, like, black and white, but, like, what you said.
When you said you have to define the term diversity, because let's say when you talked about those different communities within the university, even though your school says it's diverse, those communities also live separate from each other, so mm-hmm. then it's not really diversity,
right.
Even though you're going to the same institution.
Yeah.
Well, it's also interesting that we sometimes use diversity as a class marker, not just an ethnicity marker. And I think this, you know, ostensibly we're a classless society. You know, this is America. Everybody can rise up and down, and yet we all know the reality of living in this country. And like you say, you have to define it.
Mm-hmm.
What do we mean when we talk about these terms? And
I had a professor write it herself. Graduated, and I got my first teaching job in Santa Fe.
differentiating between the designation other and going from otherness to
saying you are another.
Another, or okay. Another, which puts everything on the same plane.
Good. All right. So we're back to this one now. National media attention is centered on solitary confinement, prisoner abuse, death row, and Angola. Discuss the local injustice system, justice or injustice system. Blacks in NOLA constitute 59% of the city. Blacks in NOLA prisons constitute 90% of the prison population. So, you get into talking about the institution of prison and the business of prison, because that's what prison is. Prison is business at the end of the day. It's not about correction. It's not about trying to really. The more and more I learn, and I'm still learning, prison is not about making society better. Prison is about control. Prison is control at the end of the day. We have decided that these are the laws, and these are the people that are influenced by the laws that have been set forth. And there are so many ways around the laws, and unfortunately, the black population in New Orleans, but also just like countrywide, are very ignorant of the laws and how to be able, because a lot of people that are not black know how to get around the laws, and we don't. We succumb to the law.
Or just not affected by it.
Yeah.
Or you could pay to get out of it. Yeah.
Right.
Appaloosa.
That's insane.
Right.
Basically given drugs by the like Reagan administration, and how it's basically like a setup. But now that like middle class white people are on heroin, they're getting more sympathy from cops. They're being treated better. They're being told to go to rehab. They're being given Suboxone, and like it's just crazy like how like it sometimes it really does. A lot of the times it really does boil down to race, and like especially when it comes to drug use, it's crazy to me how many people are like stuck in jail. Especially like persons of color who are stuck in jail because they have like weed on them. Like they're like the tiniest bit of weed. They're like the tiniest, you know. It's just like it's humanity. Like even Alfred
Woodrow.
Yeah.
It got out like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then there was the white girl who had the DA agent as a father.
Yeah.
And they called her a cute kingpin. And she was like, she wasn't literally a kingpin by drug standards, but she was doing much more than black people with the ounce of weed had on her. And they're like, and it's like the media, how the media portrays her. She's a cute kingpin, even though she's selling drugs.
To sort of bounce off of both of you guys' ideas and then also add something to that. So I think that when it comes to black folks and the law, it isn't really a situation of not knowing. I think there's plenty of times where people do know the options that are available. It's about access. And it's not, oh, I didn't know that I could pay to get something expunged. I am a systematically oppressed person who does not have the capitalist means in order to achieve that or to even do that. I was just reading an article. I was talking about how lots of people in this state go to jail without ever having had a lawyer, though you are supposed to have one. And so I would definitely say that. And then I would say that Louisiana, when you're talking about schools, when you're talking about prisons, is like could literally be a cherry-picked example of what happens when you allow capitalism into social institutions. Because what you then have, these institutions are not being motivated to do what they're actually supposed to be doing. They're motivated to do what is best for them financially. For example, I mean, prisons, obviously. It's like, why would I invest in you getting out of prison and never coming back when you're free labor, basically? So, like, that doesn't help them. And then, for example, I work at a school, I work at Clark down the street, and it is run by First Line Schools. First Line School over Clark, and they had 5 years to bring Clark from an F school up. Clark was an F school up until last year, when the end of that 5-year period came up and they were going to potentially lose that school and the associated money from it. For the last 4 months of the school year, they poured a metric shit ton of resources into the school, and in 4 months, they managed to get the kids from an F to a D. From an F school to a D school. So it's like, you had this school under your purview for 5 years and you didn't put any money or resources into it until you were being threatened with losing this money, and this is what happens when people are in it for the money. It's like, I don't care what happens there as long as the cash flow is still going.
Can you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. Hi, my name is Alarian Angelin, also known as Brown Girl Kitchen. Made the food that you're eating.
Thank you.
I'm glad that you guys enjoyed it. I thought I would stop by and see what people were also talking about.
Well, I'm part of the National Urban League Young Professionals, and I went to a conference in Memphis, I believe, and one of the guys from Atlanta, he's a police officer, and he did a session on, like, some things that he teaches teenagers about what they don't know, and it was a thing of, okay, there's a situation where, okay, somebody has an idea to go rob somebody's house, okay, they tell their two friends, okay, we're going to rob this house. One person backs out, the other two go and do this, all this stuff, and then he ends up assaulting someone or something like that. Okay, if the person backs out, the person that backs out, if they don't tell on them before it happens, they're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, that's conspiracy.
Conspiracy is a big thing that teenagers don't know about. If you know about something before it happens and you do not tell on them, you're going down for it.
Yeah.
And then another woman, I saw an older woman, she's been in prison for 20-something years. She just got out because President Obama gave her, and she was in an abusive relationship and she wanted to leave. Her boyfriend or husband was a drug dealer, and once she tried to leave, he clung her close to him and made her do the stuff of the business. Like, before she was just kind of on the wayside, but he made her be involved, and because she didn't want to leave because he was going to threaten her family, she went to prison for 20 years because of that situation, and she just got out because President Obama. So they're like,
yeah, because in that situation she wasn't being regarded as a victim, she was being regarded as a perpetrator, though she was literally doing these things by force.
Yeah.
The blind eye.
How is black life part of your daily life?
Well, I woke up being black this morning. And I looked in the mirror and I said, damn, what a great day.
I woke up like this.
Yeah, I thought that was a weird question.
Like, what about you too?
Oh, it's perfectly valid to ask what part of life black life is for me. I live in a black neighborhood. I have black friends and neighbors, but I can only experience it outside my own life, because when I look in the mirror, all I see is that I haven't shaved again. but it goes back to a question we were talking about, that question of culture and New Orleans and being a New Orleanian.
Mm-hmm.
You can never know something unless you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And some things, being in a wheelchair, I can't know except by what Peter tells me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not there. That's the same thing for another ethnicity, for another culture, for another class. You can only peer in.
and you hope that you are receptive enough to understand what you can glean from that experience.
Mm-hmm. Which is super important. I hope I'm not repeating anything that was already talked about, but I think that what you're talking about is like super relevant to the whole like colorblind issue, where it's like, I'm colorblind, everything is the same, and I don't, it's like, no, everything actually isn't the same, and what you're actually doing in saying that is you're ignoring my completely different experiences, and you're not appreciating that, or this idea, I once had a pretty heated argument with someone that went to Tulane, because he was basically trying to tell me that he knew what it was like to be black, and I was like, no, you don't. I was like, how do you know what it is like to be black? He was like, we do the same things, and I was like, how do we do the same things? And he was like, oh, well, I eat and you eat. I was like, you sound stupid. I was like, please stop, sir.
It's an emotional thing.
Yeah, it's not even just emotional. It's a cultural thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a socialization thing.
It's a spiritual, physical, and mental thing.
You have different expectations. You have different socializations. To touch on the subject of criminalization of black folks, I know for sure that you didn't get the conversation that I received as a teenager. I went to Lusher here, and I had lots of white friends because that's a school that is mixed race. And I would go and be a teenager and do reckless things, and my mother would like stop me, and she'd be like, you need to understand that you are not these white kids. If y'all were to get into any sort of trouble with the cops, first and foremost, you're most likely to go to jail. They might walk away from it, and then if you all go to jail, you don't, they have way more access to like political power. They might know somebody who knows somebody you don't know. They might have the funds to get out of this situation. You don't have any of those things. And so you need to understand that that is going to affect you completely differently. And so it's like, I'm pretty sure your mom never gave you that talk. Pretty sure.
It's super interesting that you talked about the concept of being colorblind, right? Because I think people wear that as like a badge.
Oh, they do.
Yeah.
And I think it's super insulting. Also, it's a lie.
So the interesting thing about my growing up is that my mom is very much pro-black, right? Mm-hmm. She would say things like that. She would say, like, she would growing up, I would hear her talk to people, and she would say, oh, I didn't raise my kids to see color. And again, I even growing up, I thought that was a cool thing, right? I was like, yeah, I hang out with everybody. I never, you know, think about these things. But I heard, actually it was Cornel West.
Yep.
However you may feel about Cornel West, I heard him say, that he talked about the idea of being colorblind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so profound to me because it wasn't until I was in my 20s before I was like, oh, that's not necessarily like
To love is to not be colorblind, but to be color embracing.
Exactly.
You see my color and you don't treat me different because of that, not that you don't see it.
And I mean, that was the thing, my mom is a weird person. She like is like sometimes like not, like I don't know, she's like not super pro-black at times, but then sometimes she's like super pro-black, and I'm like, I don't know what you're doing right now. Growing up, it was like Autobiography of Malcolm X, Maya Angelou, Randall Kennedy Nigger. These were like all of the books that my mom was buying me. And so, of course, I grew up to be the person that I am. And sometimes my mom acts confused about this. And I'm like, Mom, what did you think you were doing? All these books, you know, I couldn't just like read them and not pick up a thing or two. But yeah, no, like the whole colorblind thing and me being raised as such and like my family being like very embracing of like who they are. When people would say that, and like I've always been like very proud black person, say I'm colorblind, I'm like, I'm black, and I want you to know, I like it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be your grayscale. Like I'm a black person, and I would like
and
to be addressed as such.
All of the potential that's involved, like with this Black Lives Matter movement, it's all like this embracing of black culture, like very
mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily something that is new.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now that it's just being talked about more.
Yeah, there's a resurface.
Because it's being, and I think a lot of it has to do with the proliferation of like social media.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
People just constantly.
And
like,
information.
I mean,
people are aware of a lot of things
exactly.
that such a large scale. Because it's one thing for you to be like, oh man, that like crazy thing happened in my city, and it's another thing to be like, this is literally happening everywhere, and I am so tired of hearing it.
Right.
I mean, speaking of what you said, I was raised the same way. Like, my mom was always like, okay, like, you know, be friends with somebody if they respect you and treat you right and, like, don't judge you.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I got to college that I was like, you know what, like, yeah, like, racism exists. Like, I'm going to an all-white college in upstate New York. Like, I'm constantly being, like, prejudiced against, like, judged. And, like, and it took me so long to realize that, like, racism can take so many different facets and faces. And, like, I wouldn't say that I felt stupid, but, like, I, you know, I really believe what my mom was saying. And you're like, oh, yeah, like, you know, like, everything's all good, Erica. Like, you know, like, you're a star. Like, you know, you're told to do your homework. And it's like, no, that's some bullshit. I still do my homework and my coursework. And I'm still being judged and, like, put up, like, against the wall, like, every day. So, I don't know.
They had the Dalmatians as well, so he was like, oh.
said it
like,
that way.
I was like 7 or 8. I don't understand. Like, what's that even mean? And then me talking to my mom about it, and I can't imagine a parent, like, who knows what that is, to like really have to sit there and like, we need to talk about this now. Like, this is something that you need to understand about life. Because
at
of
7.
The color of your skin. You know what I mean? Like, because this is a part of, this is always going to be a part of who you are for the rest of your life. And now you need to know that.
I used to go to the YMCA like after school program, and so I had this friend Maria, who's like Italian, and then like we had like a sleepover at her house, and then like everything felt good, and then she comes up to me and she's like, Erica, and I was like, yeah, what's up? And she's like, I can't have you over my house. And I'm like, why? Like, you know, what's wrong? And then she's like, yeah, she's like, my parents don't like black people, and she's like, they don't want me to be hanging out with like another black girl. And she's like, I'm really sorry. She's like, we can hang out after school. And like, I was also confused. I was like, what? Like, what's happening? I was like, I remember crying to my mom. And I was like, I'm a nice person. Like, I don't know what went wrong. And my mom was like, you know, she's like, it's not about you. She's like, it's about racism. And then from then on, like, I was just kind of, I don't know. It's just like, it was such a profound moment for me because that had never happened to me before.
And again, speaking on that, it's just like, the thing I distinctly remember was even her being like, I don't understand either.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things, like, I don't get it either. I don't know why I can't play with you, but apparently because you're black, my dad says we can't play with you, so me and my sister, we have to go.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get up all our shit, and keep your shit, and we're leaving.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's interesting because it is, it's not, I truly don't believe that it's something that you're born. Now that's not, again, that's not to mean that when you come out, you don't, again, you see things, you see, I see differences,
no.
You look at everybody, you see differences.
There's some people did an experiment, they're like, yeah, we put toddlers together and toddlers even do choose their company by race. I was like, that doesn't count.
Yeah.
Because you pick up on stuff your parents do when
right.
you were real little.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Very young.
Because, like, my boss's daughter, it took her a long time to decide, okay, I'm going to, like, hang out with this black man because I don't hang out with any other black. She'd, like, see me and just, like, and now she'd, like, come to hang out with me and, like, sit next to me. Like, it took a long time for her, like, so there's clearly, like, something going on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wanted to let you all know that we have about 5 more minutes, so there's
and
a card that you're dying
you've
to get
to.
You've
got to do all the rest of the cards?
All of them. Quickly. Lightning round.
All right, let's get some more.
That's a good one.
So, we got, how is Nola unique in regards to activism? Who or what organization or chief mobilizes? Discuss historical legacies, defining race and class unique to Nola, unemployment rates, and discuss the privatization of public education, literacy rates, and access to college education.
I think this one is interesting.
Which one is that?
Discuss historical legacies, defining race and class unique to NOLA, colorism.
Oh, definitely.
Because that's actually, that was what I was about to say before, because this kind of ties in. Like, there was this lady who, Mama D or something, I don't know. But she was talking about how when she was younger, she's like 60 or 70. When she was younger, she was actually playing with a light-skinned girl. And she brought her to her house, and her mom went in and had a talk with her, and the light-skinned girl, and was like, oh, I can't play with you because you're dark. And that was in New Orleans. It's like, man, there's so many levels to this, and being black.
So this is good, because talking about that, that was the first time I, like, as a kid, that I had ever been confronted by race from someone outside of my race. But the first time I really experienced, like, a separation between, like, people that are different skin colors was amongst, like, my own community, was in my own family. You know what I mean? Like, me, like, I would hear it growing up. They'd be like, you know, like, I was from my own family. So, you know, they would talk about, like, me being darker than, like, other people, you know. And again,
definitely, you can see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Servitude attitude.
Coworkers were talking about this. Okay, so somehow, like, all of the black people who worked at my company came and congregated at the same time, not on purpose. It was like, this group came from this way, this one came from this way, and once we noticed, we're like, oh, shoot, we, like, gotta escape this, like, all the black people, they were thinking we were gonna, like, doing a revolution or something like that. And so, one of the guy, one of my coworkers was talking about how him and two other of the black coworkers were talking, and one of the white coworkers came and was like, oh, what are you guys talking about? And he was like, regular stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, they mentioned the black codes, how three or more black people could not be in the street congregated,
right.
And like, that residual of how people still live by the black codes. They don't know it's the black codes,
right.
But
it's like a subconscious
thing. When a group of black people congregate, I mean, unless you're like out in a Frenchman or something, like if you're at work, you're like, oh, this is too many people.
Exactly.
Like when I'm in the office, when I'm going past the office, I'm like, okay, three black women, I can't stop and talk
yeah.
to y'all. Like, I gotta keep going to my desk.
Which is crazy because like, I had the same experience. Like, I remember my junior year of high school, I was in Texarkana, Arkansas, which, you know. But being, you know, in that space, but being in that space and being in, like, I distinctly remember being in a class where, and that's what, there were like four of us, right? Four people in the whole class, and we all ended up sitting at the same table, right? But it's, no one questioned why, you know, I remember my teacher, he came over and he said, why are you guys all sitting? And I remember being so offended by it. And I said, well, I guess the same reason. No, it's just like a natural thing. Like, no, like, why is us sitting together a problem? That's not to say that I don't want to communicate with the other tables, but this is how it happened. If anyone else wants to come to the table, they are more than welcome. It's a weird space to navigate.
I don't understand why that makes people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I had something similar after October. I went to AIGA conference. And I was participating with a lot of nonprofits, and one of the women was an activist, and she wanted to get all the black designers together. So there was only like 20 of us, and like, it's like hundreds of people there.
Yeah.
And we're like, we all gathered at the lobby, and I could tell, I don't feel like I ever noticed it before until then, that like, as I was sitting there talking to them, I could see people walking by, like heads turning, like, I could tell that they were uncomfortable, like, what's going on?